Covell v. Minkins, 083245. Mr. Krajewski.
It pleases the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Phil Krajewski, and I represent Jerry Covell in this case. It's an appeal from the granting of summary judgment in our 1983 case, in which we alleged both a deprivation of a property interest and a liberty interest when Covell was terminated as director of the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Commission in August of 2003. Briefly, the facts are that Covell was the first director of the agency and came on in 1998. He was terminated on August 8th, and he was not given any hearing whatsoever. He wasn't given any reason for his termination, and even before his termination, he heard rumors of the investigation and misconduct that eventually led to his termination. We contend that the starting point for the property interest argument is the actual act itself, the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Commission Act, which authorized this position. That authorization is very, very stark and barren of detail. It strictly says the director of the commission shall be hired, supervised, evaluated, and terminated by the commission. It does not say that the director serves at the pleasure of the commission.
But that's what's in the bylaws, and that's one of the problems here, because one of the bylaws says he serves at the pleasure of the commission. The other states that he has certain rights under the personnel code, which is that he can't be terminated unless there's cause.
Well, we think the act left, like you say, it did leave the commission open to draw up the procedures here. And I think as we look at the act, it's important before I move to the bylaws to see what CMS said back in 1999 when they were trying to classify this position. CMS looked at the act, looked at the position, and said, under one interpretation, the director is covered by the personnel code. But then under another interpretation, the director is not covered by the personnel code. So Covell went to the commission and expressed this information, and the commission said at that point, leading up to the bylaws, the commission said that it wanted to exempt the director from the hiring process of the personnel code because it wanted to be free to hire a hard of hearing director, and it thought that the veteran's preference and other things in the Personnel Act might interfere with able to do that. But it also told Covell that as far as termination went, it wanted to make sure that Covell had the protection of the code. That led to the 1999 bylaw, which, as you stated, Your Honor, does have the serve at the pleasure and kind of preamble to it. But then it specifically goes down and it says that the director is to be afforded all the rights of the personnel code except for hiring. And so that's the bylaw we have at that point. And then in February of 2002, a letter is sent over to kind of firm up the hiring issue. A letter is sent to CMS and then to the Civil Service Commission to exempt the position from Jurisdiction B, which is the hiring and termination provision. And that was approved. The Civil Service Commission did exempt this position. But then, at the same time, in March of that year and April, the commission did two things. It reapproved the bylaw, which afforded the director all the protection of the personnel code except for hiring. And it also enacted Administrative Code Rule 3300.380, which read the same thing. The director shall be afforded the same rights and privileges as outlined in the personnel code except for hiring. So we rely on these regulations that specifically state what the termination and hiring situation is, and we think that this gives Covell a property interest in his job. The case law is clear that regulations such as this can be the source of a property interest, and it's also clear that even if the statute doesn't give that right, if the regulations underneath it are promulgated, that's sufficient.
So now, even if we reverse the district court on this finding and say that he was owed a hearing before termination, doesn't qualified immunity kick in? Because since regulations and bylaws and some of the applicable statutes all stated the director served at the pleasure of the commission, wasn't it reasonable for the defendants to think that he was an at-will employee?
Well, I think not.
Especially since there are no cases on point.
I think not, Your Honor, because although that general language is in there, there's no history in the record of how at the pleasure got into the bylaw.
Well,
but there's, Your Honor.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. The investigation was spawned as a result of complaints, supposedly, from a lot of people for whom he was working. So it went in an investigation, and this is when other things came out with the computer and stuff. But I'm just saying, if they are assuming that you're serving at the pleasure, then that process would sort of assume they're going in under that without, you know, I don't even know how the investigation was carried out, but apparently a lot of employees were interviewed and came up with a lot of complaints, and that's what really, at least I guess, caused his termination.
The interview did take about 30 days, and it preceded the actual vote terminating him. He was suspended about 5 days prior to the vote, so there was that process, you're right. But I don't know that the fact that there was an investigation presupposes anything about whether he's under the code or has the rights of the code, actually.
Well, I assume there's some other process when they assume he's under the code and under the for cause termination or something like that.
Well, that's what we argued there was, and we also argued that there was nothing directing the commission except its own bylaws at this point.
Right, and there are no cases that are right on point that interprets the bylaws. And then didn't they check with the personnel and other departments before they fired him? I'm trying to get to this, why they're not entitled to qualified immunity.
Well, I think because they're not entitled to it because they were on fair notice of their own bylaws. They're the ones that told Covell that they wanted him to have the protection that's afforded by the personnel code. So it seems like it's extremely clear that they wanted this protection afforded to him, and then that's an issue for the trier of fact, of course, but then they go ahead and they conduct an investigation, they terminate him, they don't tell him why. He gets information after he's terminated. He asks the chairman. The chairman won't tell him, says he don't have to tell him. So that's kind of the scenario which this went down under. Now, I think that if we look at shortly after he was terminated, in September 11th, actually, 9/11 of 03, there's a bylaw that the commission has which takes out serve at the pleasure. That language is removed. And then they go on to say that they want to afford the director all the protection of the personnel code. So I think that gives us certainly the inference can be drawn that at the pleasure was something that got in there and was not the intent of the commission.
Let me ask you, on his liberty interest claim, did you have any evidence that specific disclosures were made regarding the reasons he was fired?
Yes, Your Honor. We contend that actually two things occurred there. And we're looking at the McMath case, which we advanced another theory in our briefs. But McMath talked about there could be a publication of the stigmatizing information if it's disseminated beyond the chain of command in the department. And McMath looked at the case before it, and this particular comment about going beyond the chain came up when they looked at one of the commissioners, or one of the defendants actually, had put the derogatory information in the personnel file of the plaintiff. And the court said that certainly was within the chain of command.
Now, the derogatory information, I assume, is the pornography on the laptop, right?
That was McMath. In our case, we contend that there were really two disclosures by commissioners. The first disclosure we contend, occurred when this investigation took place. The investigation took place by both the chairman and vice chairman of the commission. And at the time this investigation occurred, Cowell, the personnel director at the commission, had testified that they went out and they interviewed staff members, and they went out and they interviewed people outside the commission. And while this is going on, Cowell says everybody knew the allegations. It was, you know, it was on the street what was going on.
Because of all the people that were interviewed were talking mm-hmm. about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and because the commissioners had disclosed, we think there's a reasonable inference, they disclosed what the allegations were to outside, you know, to everybody and their brother when they conducted the investigation.
Don't have anything specific on that. I understand that there were letters. Colville had letters sent to him from members of the public, a letter that someone sent to the governor's office, and Kyle's testimony at the child support hearing that generally the community knew about it. But you don't have anything more specific than that, do you? And McMath requires more than that.
Well, we think, Your Honor, I'm going to get on to the second point, but on this point, I hope I'm making myself clear that during this investigation, the actual allegations that ended up, the pornography on the computer and the false time records, these things became public knowledge of everybody, the staff and the people, the visitors that came in utilizing the commission. But this is precisely right at the time when the commissioners are out with this information interviewing. And the second time when there was a disclosure, public disclosure, occurred on the night of the vote. And this occurred, every single commissioner would have been involved in this, because at that vote, there were three people there that weren't commissioners, that were outside the chain, that didn't have a need to know. One was the executive secretary, and one was an administrative assistant. And there was an interpreter, which I'm not going to argue with that one. Deaf and dumb interpreter. But anyway, they were at the vote. They heard the allegations, and that was a disclosure we think that should not have occurred at all. It turns out that after that, within 2 hours, one of the commissioners drove down to Jacksonville to see his sister, ran into a guest at the house that knew of the termination and repeated these stigmatizing grounds for the termination within 2 hours. And so we think that these commissioners they disclosed, and then they set in motion emails. Colville got an email the night of the termination referring to the termination. So certainly there was actually disclosure. I think it's undeniable that they had these people that weren't in the chain of command, like McMath requires, in when this all occurred.
All right, you're into your rebuttal time. You can keep going, but you've reserved your time.
Okay. Well, and I would comment also that the governor's office was not in the chain of command either. If you look at the personnel rule, which exempted the position, the direct report was to the commission and not to the governor's office. And Colville later on lost a statewide position on a commission because the governor, knowing these allegations that were false, took his name out of that commission. So we contend there is tribal issues of fact here, and summary judgment should have not been granted.
Thank you, Mr. Krajewski. Mr. Huska?
Huzak.
Of the DuPage County Huzaks, they take it.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Anybody with that last name is related to me by not too distant degrees of propinquity, I guess. And I understand from my grandmother that being a lawyer was sort of a family disease among the Huzaks, so I'm carrying on the tradition.
Well, without adding the disease part, I'd agree with her. It's sort of a family tradition.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Richard Huzak, representing the defendants in this case, and I urge the court to...
You can raise or lower the
This will do. Thank you. To affirm the district court's entry of summary judgment for the defendants on both aspects of the plaintiff's due process claims, the property interest-based claim and the liberty-based interest interest-based claim, both on the substance of those claims and alternatively on qualified immunity grounds.
And you just started the end of his argument on the liberty interest, the argument that he made that given that the deaf community learned of the reasons for the termination when, within hours of it happening, that the only reasonable conclusion is that the commissioners leaked the information, and how that squares with the case law.
Yes, I think the McMath case is pretty much on point. It's not discussed in the plaintiff's reply brief, but it involves a situation in which non-defendants were also privy to the allegedly stigmatizing information that leaked out. And this court held that under the personal responsibility requirements of Section 1983 liability, regardless whether there might have been a due process violation, you can't establish individual liability against any person on some theory of, you know, collective culpability where we know it might have happened, you know, by somebody within some group of people, but we don't know who. Which of those defendants are going to have to pay damages for the unauthorized leak by an unknown person? Here there is also the additional factor, which the plaintiffs don't dispute, is that there were three non-defendant, non-commissioner individuals that were present at that meeting of the commission at which the decision to terminate the plaintiff was made. There was the executive director, there was a deaf and hard of hearing translator, and there was a third staff person. So it's not even clear that one of the defendants would have been the source of that leak. I think under the McMath case, that's sufficient grounds alone to establish that there was not a basis to pin liability on any one of them and make them answerable under Section 1983 for the liberty interest claim. I do want to correct a misdescription of the record. The record does not show that there was any public disclosure of information about the reasons that formed the basis for Mr. Covell's termination before the termination decision was made. A suggestion to that effect was made in the brief by the plaintiff and again at oral argument, but I think if you look carefully at the pages of the transcript of Mr. Cowles, who is not a defendant, and those are at pages 11 through 13 of the supplemental appendix submitted by the plaintiff, it'll show that there was reference to the investigation and the commissioners having to have contact with staff members in the commission as part of that. But then the reference to the public becoming aware of this information is not pinned to the timing of the investigation. It's clear that the only evidence to show that the public became aware of it is based upon evidence that that occurred after the termination. I want that to be clear. I also want to urge the court to consider certainly whether there was even a due process violation at all. And under the principles established first in Peratt and followed in the Hudson and Zinerman cases, if there's a random and unauthorized act that's not consistent with a governmental policy, then under sort of Matthews versus Eldridge balancing analysis, a pre-deprivation hearing is not required. And in this case, I think that's clearly what happened. There was an admonition to everybody in the meeting room that the proceedings were confidential, that the information was not to be disclosed outside the meeting room, and then, as human nature has it, somebody decided to leak the information. It's an unknown individual. But the risk that that type of thing may happen is not sufficient to impose upon the government, which was not officially responsible for any such disclosure, to provide a pre-deprivation hearing. If, in fact, any hearing would be required at all, the cases indicate that if the government made an official disclosure, the due process would require a name-clearing hearing. Of course, in this case, the record shows that Mr. Covell never actually asked for a hearing after his termination. But back to the due process requirements of pre-termination and post-termination process that's due under the Peratt principles, a post-deprivation state law tort remedy for defamation is all that due process requires. The government isn't violating the Constitution by not providing a hearing before the unpredictable event of an unauthorized leak of this type of information. And certainly given that aspect of the due process principles, qualified immunity, we think, would certainly be a trump card to prevent the possibility of any recovery against any of these defendants, apart from the Section 1983 individual responsibility problems.
Let me just ask you a question about this exemption business. Covell, you agree that he sent a letter to the commission asking that his position be exempted from jurisdiction B?
No, and unfortunately the evidence here, although it's somewhat muddled, if there's anything it shows that they really needed some lawyers to help them out with this process, because the way they went about this clearly indicates that they didn't understand exactly who was responsible for what and how things happened under the personnel code. But it is clear that the intent of the commission was not to have him covered by jurisdiction B of the personnel code, which puts substantive conditions upon the hiring and firing of state employees. And so my reading of the evidence, and I think it's consistent with this, is that the commission did not do this sort of counterintuitive thing of saying, we want you to be outside the personnel code for hiring and firing, but then we want to give you, by some non-personnel code method, if one does exist, the right to be terminated only for cause.
But they specifically excluded the personnel code's provision on hiring, like you said, which most of which is covered by jurisdiction B. You agree?
But they said they were excluding hiring.
But they didn't exclude the rest of jurisdiction B's rules, one of them that had the cause provision.
Okay, let me try and clarify, because I think this is confusing. The commission has no authority to decide the scope of the personnel code's application. They can request that the Department of Central Management Services exclude somebody from jurisdiction B. The statute, the personnel code statute, authorizes that. But they can't pick and choose, like menu options, which parts of jurisdiction B apply and which parts of jurisdiction B don't apply. All they can do is request CMS to approve, based upon certain criteria, that somebody be governed by jurisdictions A and C, which have to do with salary and grade and then benefits, but not jurisdiction B, which encompasses hiring and firing. So by exempting Mr. Covell from jurisdiction B, they excluded him from the personnel code's hiring and firing requirements. And I think the evidence shows that that was consistent with their understanding that they were the ones under the Act that had the power to hire and fire them. If you're under jurisdiction B, the process is that somebody submits proposed charges to the director of the Department of Central Management Services. If the director approves those charges, that commences an administrative hearing process that goes before the Civil Service Commission. And if the Civil Service Commission, not the deaf and hard of hearing commission, would have to decide what penalty would be appropriate, if any, whether it's suspension or termination, and that's subject to administrative review under the administrative review law. If, according to Covell, the commission thought that it was providing him protections against termination under the personnel code, what that would mean is that they were giving up entirely their statutory authority to make the decision whether to terminate him. And you see the provisions of those documents that they say, well, we'll have to decide it by a supermajority, and then they say, well, it's going to be a lower supermajority. Let me go back to another point. In oral argument, opposing counsel indicated that the commissioners indicated that they wanted to give him protection against termination. That's not correct. There's not a single bit of evidence anywhere in the record that suggests that anybody on the commission ever thought that they were giving the right to be terminated only for cause or limiting their power to terminate him. In fact, Mr. Covell repeatedly said in the course of this process several times that they wanted to be able to hire somebody who was deaf, and so they didn't want to have any restrictions on that. But then he also said they wanted the power to hire and fire. He said that several times in his deposition, and those transcript pages are attached to my brief as part of my supplemental appendix. It's clear that although they may have misunderstood what their role was with respect to the nature of what had to be done vis-a-vis the personnel code, that what they were doing was echoing the personnel code, not departing from it, and that the idea was he was exempt from jurisdiction B. That meant that he could be terminated for no reason at all, and that's consistent with the consistent reference that he served at the pleasure of the commission, which has always had a uniform meaning, employee at will. Let me also mention this. As a matter of Illinois law, they didn't have the power to limit their ability to fire him for no cause or any reason whatsoever. The statute gives him no statutory term. It puts no limits on their ability to terminate him. And as a matter of Illinois law, and his property rights are governed by Illinois law, and that trumps any inconsistent bylaws or regulations, that law is clear that if you have that type of statute, the person with the appointment power can't tie his own hands or a future appointer's hands to limit the ability to terminate for no reason. And that makes a lot of sense. If you give somebody the power to appoint and to revoke at will, if at the 11th hour before they leave office, they have all their cronies and they purport to give them contracts to, you know, serve as the dog catcher for life, it trumps the legislature's determination that that position is one at will. This is a statutory aspect of Illinois law that the rules are consistent with and couldn't be inconsistent with, and that the bylaws couldn't be inconsistent with. Let me close with one thought about the property interest claim. To the extent that there's any uncertainty, and I think that the evidence overwhelmingly supports an interpretation that the commission never intended to impose a for-cause requirement on termination, it is not a jury question. It is a question of law for the court to decide. So even if there was any uncertainty, it was something for the court to resolve. And in this case, the district court looked at everything and said the commission simply wanted to have him exempt from jurisdiction B, which they did by going through the CMS process, and otherwise he could be subject to the personnel code. And so if you think that there's any ambiguity here, and you have de novo review, and you look at this issue, and you agree with the district court that the better interpretation was that he served at the pleasure of the commission, he was terminable at will, then that's the end of the matter. The fact that somebody else could argue that another interpretation is plausible doesn't mean it goes to a jury and that summary judgment is improper. This is because it's a question of law involving the meaning of a statute and the meaning of a regulation, which is interpreted like a statute. There's no possibility of a jury trial. All the evidence is in front of the court, and it must decide as a matter of law what the correct interpretation of those provisions is. And we submit that the district court was correct, ruling that it does not give him any right to be terminated only for cause, and as a result, he did not have a constitutionally protected property interest, and for that reason, summary judgment was proper. Failing that, qualified immunity certainly protects all the defendants against the plaintiff's claims in this case. We urge the court to affirm summary judgment on both claims.
Thank you, Mr. Husak.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Krajewski? How much time? 1.5 minutes, and we should find out where your family is from since we know where Mr. Husak is from.
Generation here.
They're from here?
Oh, I'm from Illinois, downstate Illinois.
All right. Go ahead.
Thanks for asking.
And that didn't cut into your time.
Oh, thanks. Okay. I think there may be a misapprehension of the position we're taking on the McMath case and the chain of command issue here. We contend that the public disclosure was made at the hearing to the unauthorized people that were present and outside the chain of command and did not have a need to know what these allegations were that the vote was taken upon. After that, that was not a leak. That was a direct allowance of the people to be in there and hear all this.
Who were the unauthorized people that were at the...
The unauthorized meeting? People... there was a sign interpreter, which, you know, I'll grant was proper in there, but there was also the administrative assistant was in there, and there was an executive secretary that were present taking it all in, not voting, not making a decision, and had no need to know to be in there.
So they could spread whatever rumor. Well, without the commission knowing it, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I mean, leaks occurred later on, but that was the disclosure there that all defendants engaged in. And then we have them.
Oh, I see.
And then the executive secretary, was that executive secretary to the commission someone who was taking notes?
Yes. Well, I don't know if they took notes. The record's unclear, but she was present there and the administrative assistant. There's no suggestion what official capacity she had either. We also, the council raised the Parrott case and the Random Act, which certainly was not raised in the district court, and I don't think it should be considered up here. This certainly was not a random act like in that prisoner case. It was the commission proceeding on its policies on how it's going to terminate this one position. So that was certainly exactly what liberty and property interests are involved in. Now, Cowell's testimony, or actually Cowell's testimony, he was a personnel officer. He specifically stated, and I'll just call your attention to pages 32 and 33 of his deposition, that these actual allegations were known in the office and on the street. So if you review those pages, I think you'll see it was not just the investigations going on, but the allegations were known.
All right. Thank you. Your time is up.
Your Honor.
We'll take the case under advisement.